Cambridge 105.
Community radio in your city.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
It's 12 o'clock on Saturday the 29th of June and you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 with Matt Bentman and Alan Alder.
And on today's programme we found out about falafels, the food set to challenge the current fast food trends.
Alan catches up with Clara Paul of the Books for Cooks bookshop in Notting Hill to give her recommendations on the latest titles.
And we discover how the different types of honey are made.
Ruth will not be with us today because she's in Barcelona celebrating her birthday. She'll be back for the next episode, so for the meantime, happy birthday, Ruth. And she's been good to us. She's provided us an interview with a company called Crane's Alcoholic Cranberry. More on that later.
And for our regular features, wine critic Tom Lewis will be joining us towards the end of the show to talk about wines for the summer. And we'll finish with a review of interesting food and drink articles you'll be able to find in today's newspapers. So let's begin. And here on Flavour, we visit plenty of shops, cafes, restaurants and attend local events and talk with specialists to give you an idea of the spectrum of food and drink in Cambridge. And on the menu this time is Middle Eastern street food or fast food, depending on your terminology.
Falafel. Falafel, as my Spanish friend says. According to the media, over the coming few years, the falafel is set to make a serious dent in the consciousness of the UK fast food industry. And here in the centre of Cambridge, Market Street to be precise, opposite the Fat Face shop, this Middle Eastern food is already available and served by a well-established family-run business. Called the Taste of Cambridge, this food store specialises in falafels, salads, pizza wraps and soups. And today I am speaking with Arthur, and Arthur runs the Taste of Cambridge along with his sister. Arthur, welcome to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Arthur, first off, can we have a brief explanation of the falafel, where it's from and what a listener can expect to get if they order one from you?
Going into Wikipedia, they would say that the falafel originated in Egypt. I'm not sure if I can trust that because every single person that I speak to from the Middle East seems to think that the falafel originates in their country. So I wouldn't like to say it comes from here or it comes from there. I know it's delicious, it's healthy, you can make it into a wrap, you can make it into a salad box, served with tahini, it's an amazing thing. And we've been doing it since 2009. It's been very popular. The first couple of years it was fairly slow because people weren't used to that particular dish, but now falafel has really taken off and we're really proud to be serving it in town.
Have you always been established in the same spot in town?
Yes, since 2009. But we also go to events, college balls, and we're getting more and more requests to do these types of events.
Oh, good. So things are very much picking up.
Absolutely, yeah. We're very delighted with that.
Shall we explain some of the foods that you have on offer here? Now, it's chiefly organic, free-range and locally sourced ingredients that you use.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we cover the variety of falafels you serve? Oh, how about where you get your ingredients from?
Yeah, we get stuff, especially in the winter, from Simon in the market. He gets a lot of decent products, so I get a lot of his stuff for my soups that I use and some of the salads. Rocket, he does lovely Rocket, so we get some of his stuff from him, so it's a good place to go. But because we've got such a broad menu in terms of falafels, we can't get everything from him, so we go to other suppliers as well in Cambridge.
Now let's cover some of the particular falafel dishes that you provide here. You have classic, garden, fiery and four seasons falafels.
Yeah.
Would you like to talk about some of them for the listener?
When we say classic, people from the Middle East, they will say that's not a classic because with our classic we offer fresh grated carrot salad with spring onions, with a vinaigrette on it, dash of lemon juice and red pepper. But that's not a classic from the Middle East.
Yeah.
So it's a classic that we've named it for our customers. And that's the first falafel or the wrap that we first done. And it really will, you know, it's a delicious thing. And then we started to add all the others as the request for the falafel became bigger and bigger.
Okay.
So we've just gradually added the others. So we've started with a classic and then we added the garden, which is tomato, pepper, cucumber, with the vinaigrette, fresh coarse lettuce, tahini on top, and the falafel, and it's served in this beautiful flat bread that you can just heat up, fold it, and it's presented in a nice, tidy way that you can just walk away and eat it.
The classic falafel that you mentioned just now, is that something that you adapted or created for the British palate?
Absolutely, yes. I looked at it and I said, we can do many things with a falafel. You can add fresh ingredients to it. You can add all sorts of flavours, and creating flavours is one of my passions, and I like to really play with this in the kitchen. And the classic one was something that came to me immediately. You will be amazed of what a dash of lemon juice does to a carrot salad.
Yeah.
And it was so refreshing, and the feedback also from people was great. So I thought, we're going to start with this and then see what the steak is. But the carrot is just an amazing stuff.
Well, those ingredients, I'd like to talk a little bit more about them. Some of your falafels, as you were describing just now, they come with tahini-based sauces, I understand. Now, tahini is made from ground-hulled sesame seeds, which are soaked in water and then crushed to separate the bran from the kernels. It's full of calcium and protein, and it's good for vegetarian and vegan diets.
Absolutely, yes, and it's really delicious. It's almost like a nutty flavour, creamy nutty flavour. It's super rich, and sometimes you will also have to dilute it with a bit of lemon juice or even a little water. And to accommodate for a broad range of people, we also try to make things vegan. So then we add vegan yogurt to our tahini.
Oh.
And that is used to create our dressing.
Yes.
And that way you cover the vegetarians and the vegans alike.
And one of the other ingredients I noticed are harissa. Have I pronounced that right?
Harissa, yes. It's typically a Moroccan spice. Mm-hmm. And it's mainly made of spiced peppers. But it's beautiful. It just brings out the flavour in the dish.
A spice or a chili sauce?
It's spiced peppers.
Okay.
Yeah, it's grinded spiced peppers. And that's not too hot. In fact, it's becoming really popular. People are really asking more and more. And once you start to have a dash, you come back and you want to have a little extra. I even created an extra hot harissa, which is really, really popular. But then again, it's very spicy. But it's beautiful, it's beautiful. We even had people from Thailand coming here and they said to me, please hit me with it because I'm used to it. I come from a spicy country where we use a lot of spices, and the lady turned back and said, that was really spicy.
I was wondering if such an ingredient might split your audience or whether it is choice to all nationalities.
I think it's a choice to all nationalities. I think you can gradually introduce such ingredients. I think a little spice in food releases the flavours and other things. If you don't go overboard, I would obviously approach spice with a little care.
You do sound like a guy who's happy to experiment.
I do spend long hours in the kitchen, but it's something that I do. I even go to the kitchen at midnight and bake cakes and things like that. And when we did open our business, I spent 14 hours a day in the kitchen. But I'm proud that I've done it.
Now, as well as the falafels, you also do pizza wraps. And you do, say, tomato and basil, grilled mushroom, and roasted vegetable.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned you can also add falafel to that as well.
You can indeed. We've started with the pizza wraps last year, or in fact, maybe longer than that, to accommodate for some of the tourists that come in the summer.
Mm.
Because some of them, especially the one from Spain and Portugal and Italy, they're not quite familiar with falafel. So we weren't quite attracting those sort of people. So the minute we put pizza in there, they were drawn to it. And as soon as they saw us making the falafel, actually they wanted also the falafel. So that was a good way of also introducing to new people. But we can add the falafel. We use our flatbread and we just add the tomato sauce and the rest of the ingredients and add the falafel with the cheese on top, which goes into the oven and it melts and you wrap it. And it's just an amazing thing.
So a very good idea to have the pizza here then.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also children really like it, so it's a way of start to
introduce them.
In fact, this summer I will be introducing smaller wraps because I think it's a good thing to start introducing to children.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is no really an option for children in terms of a healthy front.
Yeah.
They have the option of the hot dog or the burgers, etc. But I believe that the minute we start offering something slightly cheaper, in the sense the parent will not be paying £4 for a dish that the child might not eat, but they will be willing to pay maybe £2, and if they don't eat, the parent will likely finish it.
Yes.
So that's something that I'm going to start doing as well, because I've got a 2-year-old, and I got the idea from him because I got home with a wrap one day and he just stopped biting it and he nearly finished it, and I was like, I must do this for the children.
Tried and tested already.
Yes, absolutely. So I think this is where we're going. I really believe that we should really be offering.
Now, as you alluded to just now, the price of your falafel dishes here, they do represent, clearly, a better value and also healthier than stopping off at, say, a burger chain or for a hot dog. You get more food for your pound here and no long queues, of course. And even if there is a queue, you'll get to be out here in the sunshine.
Yeah, I mean, we do get queues in our days because we're becoming quite popular. Mm. But we do offer value for money. You order one of our wraps and that's your lunch done. You won't have to get the extra crisps. You won't have to get the extra snacks for the afternoon. You know, it's one of those for under £5. Our prices vary from £4.15 to £4.55. Mm-hmm. And for that price, you literally get a meal. And it's satisfying, delicious and healthy. And you can take it to your office, eat it at your desk, can eat it later in the day. You don't have to eat it straight away. Yeah. Ideally, I would recommend that you eat it straight away. It's the best way to enjoy it as it's fresh, but you can even take it home and reheat it with some of them.
And what made you create the Taste of Cambridge, Arthur? Is it porting over a family tradition, turning it into a business, or have you worked in the food industry previously?
I did work in the food industry for 10 years, managing restaurants mainly. But I wasn't completely satisfied because I was in the forefront of things, managing the businesses. And I found myself after work going into the kitchen more and more. And I think there was a clue there. So I decided to quit my job. I didn't know what to do next. And within a month, this opportunity came for me to actually run this vegetarian food business. And I said, I will go for it. It's my passion. I'm passionate about offering something fresh, healthy to the public. And it's my creation. So I like to...
All the better then, I suppose, to work for yourself rather than someone else and to keep the passion strong.
Absolutely. I'm satisfied till this day, you know, and I like to create new things and I offer specials on a regular basis as well. And creating is my passion, you know, playing in the kitchen with flavours is what I like to do. So it's just happened out of the blue, but I went full tilt and I'm delighted that I've made that decision.
You know. And it's worked. And it's not a job, it's fun.
It is fun. It has to be fun, you know, because there are a lot of long hours in this type of business. So you really have to enjoy it once you go into it.
Now, Cambridge is a hugely multicultural and transient town, but extrapolated across the country, you know, we love a multitude of foods from different nationalities, Indian, Italian, French, Chinese, Caribbean. Do you see Middle Eastern food as being a rather steady constant here or increasing in popularity as younger generations grow older? Or do you think I'm just over-romanticising? I mean, this is clearly a well-designed, tasty and nutritious, healthy, good food.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think the British population has become more and more open to different foods, to global, you know, the world now, it's, you know, has become accessible to all sorts of people, you know. And food is from different countries. People in this country, I believe, they are experimenting more and more with different foods. And my experience is that the British population is open for this. And they're going for it. And they can see where there is value for money and where there is health. Mm. You know, the healthy side of things. And it's just an obvious choice, I think, for a lot of them.
Well, Arthur, thanks once again for agreeing to do this interview. You can find the Taste of Cambridge food stall. It's open 4 days a week from Wednesday to Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Market Street, opposite the Fat Face clothes shop. And you can also visit them on the web. That's tasteofcambridge.co.uk. Or you can email them, info@tasteofcambridge.co.uk. Customers can also call you, yes?
Absolutely, yes. I'm always open. So.
And their number is?
0771-551-260.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Arthur.
Thank you.
Now, following that interview, I tried their Four Seasons falafel wrap, and it was indeed, as Arthur says, a complete meal, full of flavour. A large falafel wrap with layers of taste as you worked your way down. Here's the falafel, there's the mango chutney, the olives, here's a seam of mint dressing, there's the marinated tomatoes. It easily kept me going until dinner time.
No, warm, warm.
They were superb. Yeah, well worth the money.
Right, I went to Books for Cooks in Notting Hill on Wednesday, Matt, while you were no doubt munching your way through a falafel. And Books for Cooks is a specialist cookbook shop with an extraordinarily knowledgeable and helpful staff. It also has a test kitchen in which recipes from recently published books are tried out by Clara Poole. So can there be anyone better to recommend a book? The number of new cookbooks being published is always small in the first half of the year, but it's picking up now, and Clara picked the best to talk about.
So the first one is called Master It, How to Cook Today by Rory O'Connell. So this kind of holds a special place for me because he is the sister of Dorina Allen, who has set up many years ago the Ballymaloe Cookery School in Cork in Ireland, and I trained there. as have many other names that we all know at the moment. And so she's, Rory is her brother, and he's very quiet and enigmatic and amazing to watch at cooking. And there were rumours the whole time I was there, which was nearly four years ago, that Rory was going to write a book. And now finally we have it. And he's very chic and understated, so it's a very chic grey, white and pink cover.
And a very big book, actually.
But actually, it's a very simple concept. It's taking classics such as roast chicken, broths and soups, a few sweet things, base really nice sides and salads and fish. And so it's not necessarily packed full of recipes, but I think his idea is master those few things. So the perfect roast chicken, really, who doesn't love roast chicken? So this is a great book for that.
Right, but are we so imperfect in our cooking of it that we need advice?
Well, I think it's a good idea. Yeah, I think people, you know, encouragement on how long to put it in the oven for, tips. This has got great tips on flavourings and different methods, kind of variation of cooking. Very beautiful photography. Here is an example of casserole roast chicken with French tarragon, alongside casserole roasting of chickens and then just oven roasting of chickens. Lots of tips about potatoes and all the different ways you can serve potatoes and enjoy them. Other chapters are simple soda breads, the pulses, which are perhaps a bit forgotten, so I think that's a good one. Mm. Soups. I mean, it is probably more of a beginner's book. It's a guide, you know, it's to encourage and get you going and give you
tips. But
you
can also forget things, can't you?
Exactly.
Because there are lots of things you can do with potatoes, and we tend to either roast them, boil them, or chip them, don't we?
I think potatoes are one of life's great vegetables. It's very simple. I think everyone I've spoken to who knows Rory or went to Bally Millie says it's so Rory, which I think is true, and that is definitely a compliment.
So, and he works there as well, does he?
Yes, he's also one of the teachers there, and he's worked in restaurants all around the world, very successful. And yeah, this is a great book. I love it. Maybe sentimental for me, but I think it's a good book to, a bit more advanced than, you know, a Delia how-to, I would say, but kind of within that realm.
Right, so that's Rory O'Connell, Master It, How to Cook Today. Right, good.
So next up is an old friend of Books for Cooks and me, and I think we've mentioned him in the past, James Ramsden.
And he's the one with the...
The Secret Larder Supper Club, which I suppose has been one of the most successful and now well-known supper clubs to have kind of popped up in London. I must have been doing it for, you know, 3 or 4 years, I'd
say.
So
he's still at it, is he?
Still at it.
And this is in his flat?
He now is in a new location, right, in a funny little kind of wine shop called, I think, Corks and Bottles, or Corks and Wine Screws or something, in East London. And I went there actually a couple of weeks ago, and it was great, delicious as always. Bit of a different setup, but I think he was doing very well. And this is his second book, Do Ahead Dinners, a lot of which I think is inspired by his supper clubs and the menus that he has cooked at them. So again, he's got a really big variety of recipes, and what I think is very clever about this is he has tart, tweak and tomorrow for each recipe. So tarting it is kind of sprucing it up a bit. Tweaking it is maybe swapping some of the recipes, flavours, and then tomorrow how you can use the leftovers. So it's a really great idea, and again, lovely, lovely, beautiful photography of stills of delicious looking dinner tables. And recipes that have stood out for me, which there was a really good one with veal that was quite interesting. Oh, here we go, sorry, I'll take that back. Braising of beef with roasted bone marrow. And the format's very straightforward. I think, knowing him, it's definitely got lots of his personality in it. And he's got nice anecdotes, perhaps, of when he served them at one of his supper clubs, or where the inspiration comes from.
Potted pork with pickled rhubarb.
Yeah,
well, that's
so
not
delicious.
Something I've come across.
No.
So there's some quite nice combinations.
Yeah, quite nice combinations.
I see as you're flicking through.
Also, more interesting things like farro risotto with blue cheese and walnuts, not just, the normal arborio rice risotto that we all think of. And the styling is great as well. He also went to Ballymaloe, that reminds me. So he'll, I'm sure, be singing the praises of Rory's book as well. Fennel soup with brown shrimp and dill. Sounds delicious. And again, not your standard kind of boring soups and expected recipes. So yeah. I think
it's a very attractive book. It's a very attractive book. Nice layout, nice photographs too.
And it's nice because it gives you all the options for hosting a dinner or a lunch or having your friends over. And he has some suggested menus at the back and tips about not necessarily running a supper club, but entertaining. So that's a really great book. I'm really pleased to see that he has a second one out.
Right, okay. And that's called again?
Do Ahead Dinners, James Ramsden.
Mm. And this is just recently published?
Yeah, this is 2 weeks possibly, yeah. If that, a week.
Yeah, it looks great.
This is the only copy we have in the shop so far, so it's very new. Next up is Rick Stein's India, In Search of the Perfect Curry. So this is tied in with his BBC series, but it's great. He really pulled it out of the bag with his Spain book, which I think no one expected. And this, again, is similar. It's very thoroughly researched, you can see, and really densely filled with great, great photos and really good recipes, and also really focusing on the regional elements of Indian cooking, which I think is really nice, and kind of covering the whole land and all the different styles there are of cooking, actually, within Indian cuisine. He's reliable for not having overly complex recipes. And
actually, I think because he's a TV chef, he will probably introduce people to the idea of the fact that there is a lot of regional variation.
Yeah, exactly, which is a really good thing.
It's not all something in a sort of spicy,
not just a curry, exactly. Yeah. I think the anecdotes seem very nice, and references to where he found the recipes and why, and also filled with, you know, tales of his trip whilst filming it, yeah, and writing it. So it's good, and the photos are beautiful.
Right,
really,
and do
bright.
You know how readily available the ingredients are?
I think most of these are now. Things like coconut you can find very easily, grated, or coconut milk. Garam masala, I think most supermarkets have that spice mix.
Yeah.
I think probably, to his credit, he has incorporated ingredients that aren't necessarily too off the beaten track, as it were.
Good.
And most people, I think, now are really up on their lingo for Indian cuisine, so maybe should feel confident using this. So I think that's a thumbs up.
Right, okay, thank you. That's Rick Stein's India, In Search of the Perfect Curry.
Third is Sicily, simply titled, published by Faden, who are renowned, and I'm sure I've mentioned before, for really beautifully put together books. And this is lovely. It's got a very simple cover with Mount Etna in the background.
Oh yes, there it has. Yeah.
And again, having been in cooked in Sicily recently, this is beautiful. It's a bit more low-key than other Faden books. They're often very lavishly photographed and put together, but actually this is quite simple, and again it's regional.
Pretty good photos, all the same.
Yeah, great photos. Yeah. So it's working around the regions of Sicily, which is nice, because actually the cuisine, what I've discovered, varies quite differently across the island, north and south and east and west, and where you are and what's available. So this pays testament to that, which is really, really good. Mm. And typically not overly complicated recipes for a Faden book, very kind of comprehensive instructions, not too lengthy or overly complicated. And yeah, the photography is absolutely beautiful, and Sicily I think is very on trend at the moment.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
It's having a revival, well, not necessarily a revival, a renaissance, and it's good. This is a really nice book. I've done a few of the past editions and they've all been delicious.
Right. There's two Sicilian cafes just opened in Cambridge, one of which certainly is enormously successful and popular, but they don't do meals. It's not a restaurant. They'll do pizzas and they'll do a lot of pastries. So does it have that sort of thing in? Does it have pastries?
Yeah, I think the pastries, yeah. Pizza, I'm not so sure about in Sicily, but definitely the pastries are amazing. Cannoli is one of these classic Sicilian pastries, which is kind of like a crisp shell filled with ricotta.
Yes, that's
one of
the things.
Which I think are totally delicious.
Yeah.
And also lots of the biscuits and quite kind of simple pastries are really delicious there, and they are definitely all covered in here.
Yeah.
And lots of delicious seafood as well. And like cassata siciliana, this is a really classic Sicilian, I say cake, more a dessert really. And marzipan and almond cannoli, here we go. Marzipan and almond are used a lot in the sweet baking. So they were the recipes for this, for those and other delicious looking things. So I think that's a good one to like broaden the perspective, the rainbow of cookbooks.
Yeah, I think that will go down well.
Okay, so this is number 5, yes. So this is called Cher.
Oh, sorry, did we say who Sicily was by?
It's Faden.
Okay, right.
They don't have an author as such. So this is Cher, which is a book that has been published and printed by Women for Women International, and 100% of the profits of sale of this book go to the Women for Women International charity. And it's a charity where basically a woman sponsors a woman in selected countries and you donate money and help her to get training or care for her family, etc. And this is a really great book. A, the cause is brilliant and it's filled with stories about people who have benefited from this programme and those who've contributed. And the recipes are all donated, as it were, either by famous/celebrity chefs, people who have done humanitarian work with Women for Women, and also people involved in the charity. So it's really great. So I know that Ottolenghi has a salad in here, which is his lentil and goat cheese salad, which is delicious. I know that Hugh Fernley Whittingstall has donated one. Jamie Oliver has apple berry pie. And each chef or whoever has donated the recipe, be it them a participant or a donor, has a little anecdote, and there are stories throughout, well, not stories, but information and facts about the selected country. So for example, we're on Kosovo here, and there are figures for the population, the conflicts that have taken place there, the internally displaced person. So it's a really great cause, and we had the launch here at Books for Cooks, and it's very inspiring, and it's a really great book to buy and know that all of your money is being sent to the right place. And also, as a bonus, it's filled with really great recipes. There's a delicious aubergine curry that I'm just flicking through to look for,
but also some recipes from places that you don't normally know about, like, and you don't know about Kosovan
Rwandan. We're in Rwanda now. And also, you know, it's rare that you would get a book filled with such a wide variety of recipes. And actually, I've landed on the page which is spinach and tomato dal, which indirectly comes from Books for Cooks because it is donated by Peter Kindersley, whose daughter is one of the owners of Books for Cooks. So that's another good reason to go and buy it. Yeah, it's great. And there's Iraqi recipes. There are really beautiful photos as well. It's really, you know, a heartwarming book as well. And like I said, I think it's really good to support and contribute in this way. And the ladies who had their launch here said they hoped that someone would buy this book and invite their friends over for dinner and cook from it, tell them about the book and the charity, and hopefully that little bit of information will spread.
Yeah.
So that's really good. So it's called Share, and it's the Women for Women International charity.
Right, with a foreword by Meryl Streep.
With a foreword by Meryl Streep. And I think it was Mia Farrow's blueberry pancake recipe, isn't there? So everyone surely wants to know that. So number six is Thai Street Food by David Thompson. And this is just a reissue, but it originally was in a huge, very beautiful kind of coffee table book format, which was not practical in the kitchen. So they've it's exactly the same recipes, but now it is just in a more manageable size. And they've updated the photography, and it's a really great book to have for Thai food if you're into Thai cooking. I'd say it's got every recipe you could definitely want, from street food to kind of more high-end, and it's got the quintessential information that you need. And it's just really good, and I think it's a very good idea that it has been reprinted in a more accessible size, because it's massive. And the photos are great of Thai street life. Are really good, and he's got lots of good tips as well. I mean, he really knows, this is David Thompson, he really knows what he's talking about. He's a real expert. Again, there's lots of the regionality of Thai food, backgrounds to dishes and the flavours, so it's good. Braised mackerel with palm sugar and shallots looks delicious.
Yes, it does. Yeah, in fact, it does look like a very nice book.
Yeah, and it's got a nice border, it's very bright, and that's making me hungry looking.
It's very Thai.
Very Thai, exactly. So that's good. I think everyone should have a good Asian book, and a Thai one is a good one.
Okay, so that's
to have.
Thai Street Food by David Thompson. Yeah, which is also still quite a big
it
book.
It is still,
isn't it?
Yeah.
But as you say, it's more usable in the kitchen.
Yes, I mean,
it?
I'd say a quarter of the size of its predecessor.
Okay.
And that was Clara Paul giving some very useful recommendations for new cookbooks.
And is Tim Hayward's book out yet?
Oh, nearly. The public
publication date is the 4th of July and it's called Food DIY. And I hope we can get Tim along to talk about it before the next programme. But there is an extract in today's Financial Times and we'll talk about that later.
OK, and is there going to be a pop-up for the Fitzbillies too, I wonder?
Well, yeah, you would have thought so because they do have one the first Wednesday of every month, but there isn't going to be one in July, but there is in August on the first Wednesday.
OK, when's that going to be?
It will be a night of Vietnamese food and you just turn up. There's no booking. But by the way, there is a very interesting pop-up at Balzano's in Cherry Hinton Road on the 21st of July with food by chefs David Underwood and Vladimir Hromek from Alimentum and the University's Riverside Restaurant. Vladimir was a semi-finalist at the Roux Scholarship, so it should be an incredible night. And on the subject of amazing food, Sean Townsend of Eat Cambridge told me a few months ago about how good the Street Food Festival in London is. Well, it's about to happen again, the 4th to 7th of July, in fact, in Brick Lane Yard. You need to buy tickets in advance and can do so from the We Feast website.
And Clara Paul will be back in a fortnight's time to recommend a cookbook that is an old favourite of hers and to talk about London food trends.
Yeah, and the ones that she's just recommended, just to remind everybody, are Rory O'Connell, Master It, James Ramsden, Do Ahead Dinners, Rick Stein, India, In Search of the Perfect Curry, Sicily, published by Faidon, P-H-A-I-D-O-N, Share, which is a Women for Women charity book published by Women International, and Thai Street Food by David Thompson. And remember that Books for Cooks does a mail order service. You just go to their website for more information. And if you want to go to the shop itself, which I recommend, it's open from Tuesday to Saturday, but is usually closed for the whole of August. It's in Blenheim Crescent off Portobello Road.
OK, thanks, Alan. And still to come on Flavour Today, we'll learn about a new alcoholic drink, fermented cranberries. Tom Lewis will be here later on to talk about summer wines, and of course we have our review of the latest food and drink articles in today's newspapers. You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Now, we've taken quite an interest in bees lately. We recently replayed an interview that we did with Alison Benjamin, author of A World Without Bees, and Roger Frost of Cambridge 105's excellent science show recently spoke with a Cambridgeshire beekeeper.
It was by chance that I met Steve Poyser give a talk at a village event. He keeps hundreds of thousands of bees, and so I went to see him.
I'm a hobby beekeeper who, for various reasons, have ended up keeping up to 20 hives of bees for my own personal use, and then the surplus honey is disposed of. But I have become a member of the Cambridge Beekeepers Association and have been for 30 years, and have past been secretary, chairman, show secretary.
Now, you're going to help fill in some gaps in my education about bees. First question that comes to mind, what is honey?
Honey is a collection of nectars which the bees will collect, take back to the hive. They do not collect honey, they collect nectar from the flowers, which is basically a bribe given by the flowers to enable the bees to come to pollinate the flowers. And the act of pollination is a byproduct of the bees robbing the flowers of the nectar. They bring that nectar back. It will have a water content of between 30% and 90%, depending on the different flowers. The bees have to then evaporate the moisture out of that, which they do within the hive, to get it down to 20% or below in order for it to become honey. They cannot store it above 20% moisture, otherwise it will ferment. So they have to reduce the moisture content down. And depending on what flowers they've been feeding on, that's how you arrive at different honeys with colour, flavour, aroma, texture, speed of setting. All of that is dictated by the bees. The honey itself is a combination of sugars, once they have done the processing, with about 79% sugar of different sorts, and this is fructose, dextrose, sucrose, and other bits and pieces. There is only about 3% of other things within the honey which actually makes the difference between different flavours. The vast majority of it is exactly the same. And you cannot artificially make honey. You can only have honey from honeybees, because in the process of them evaporating the moisture out, they absorb some honey within to their, what they call a honey stomach, and then they pass it backwards and forwards between bees, regurgitating it and evaporating the moisture away, adding amino acids and other things from within themselves. That is what will create the honey.
Well, I can buy all kinds of honey. I can buy the white honey, I can buy the clear honey. clarify what... clarify the difference between the two.
Right. All honey will set eventually, just as a result of the nature of the sugar content of it. So oilseed rape honey will set within a week of the fields going from yellow to green. And it will set solid in the hive to such a degree that the bees won't even be able to eat it without them fetching water to dilute it. Lime honey will take maybe 4 years to set, and it takes a very long time to crystallise. The beekeeper will usually take off the honey from the hive and will then store it and allow it to set. That first set tends to produce quite coarse crystals of sugar. Then the beekeeper will warm it up to a degree and to liquefy it, and will then either process it by filtering and putting it into jars and selling it as liquid honey, or they will blend it with a honey that has already set, and that is what produces what you call the white honey, which is creamed honey, where the sugar crystals that you have already allowed to set, you blend at a rate of about 10% of those to 90% of liquid honey, which then stimulates all of the whole of that honey by mixing that very thoroughly to set to the same consistency of the seeded crystals that you put in. That's how you end up with a margarine-type spread of set honey. Similarly, those crystals can be melted down, so by merely warming that jar of honey up, it will go back to liquid honey, and it will be impossible to tell it from a jar of liquid honey next to it.
Goodness me. You said ageing had something to do with the setting.
Yes.
The stuff in the shop doesn't seem to turn from browny liquid to white creamy, does it?
No, it will eventually, and there's nothing wrong with it. It is a natural process, and it's actually a sign of quality where it starts to granulate. People will perceive that a jar of liquid honey that suddenly got what looks like bits of grit and granules at the bottom of it or halfway up the jar, it must be going off. No, it's actually a sign of quality, those sugar crystals just growing in the honey. In order to liquefy it again, you just warm it up slightly and it will go back to a liquid state and away you go again. So there is no need to actually throw honey away that has started to crystallise.
What is the benchmark of good honey?
All honey will taste differently depending on what the flowers are. Personally, I like the light, what I would call aromatic, flowery honey, which tends to be quite light in colour. Other people like very dark honey, which can be ivy or one of the sort of more tree-based honeys as opposed to flowers. So they will produce a darker honey, which tends to be thicker, stronger in flavour, very pungent, and you don't need much of it to significantly impart that flavour through the whole of the product you're trying to eat, whereas the more floral honeys you would.
Steve, that is fascinating. Thank you very much.
That was Steve Poyser. You can find out more about this from the Cambridgeshire Beekeepers Association. Their website is www.cbka.org.uk.
And thanks to Roger Frost of Cambridge's 105 Science Show for that. And it really was interesting. Lots of things I didn't know there. The Science Show is on fortnightly, as is Flavour, and in fact is on today from 2:30 until 3 o'clock, and is well worth listening to.
Certainly is. Now, for our next feature, Ruth spoke to Dan, one half of the partnership of the new alcoholic drink Cranes, which he makes, sells and markets with his twin brother Ben. Launching in February, the drink made from fermented cranberries has already made a big entrance. With 1,000 bottles produced every week, it's already being sold in off-licences, some bars and pubs, and has been a big success across several of the large fairs. Here's Ruth finding out what all the hype is about.
So tell me, what is Cranes?
Cranes is a new alcoholic drink which is fermented purely from cranberries. It's quite unique, it's very different.
Okay, so how do you make it if it's fermented purely from cranberries?
Technically, we're made wine, so what we have to do is we get the cranberries, we crush them up, then we add sugar and yeast, let it ferment, and then that's pretty much it, really. It's a quite a simple process, but effective, I guess.
Cool. Important. So why did you start making it?
Why did you say? Well, me and my brother, we graduated from uni and realised you can't get a job. So we thought, let's try and do something ourselves. My brother came up with the idea around a family barbecue a couple of summers ago, and we thought, right, no one's given it a go before, it's unique, there's a gap in the market for it. So we thought we'd give it a go, try some recipes, and we found a recipe that worked, liked it, So then we started brewing it, and we thought, let's go for it. So there's something there.
Oh, cool. When did this happen then?
So we graduated last summer, that's when we initially started on with the recipes. That took about three or four months to get the recipe right. And then the next stage was to get the brewery up and running. So we worked on that until about January this year. And then we can produce about 1,000 bottles a week, which is pretty good going for the size we are.
Yeah.
And then we started selling in February. So it's so far it's going really well. We're pleased with the progress.
Oh, only in February?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So where do you sell?
The best place to go is our website, and there's a list on there, where there's a page whereabouts, where there's a list of everywhere we're stopped.
Okay.
And that's the best place to go, but we're in quite a few free houses around Cambridge, and most of the offer licences as well.
That's really good.
But recently we've been so busy with some big events like the Cambridge Beer Festival, the Strawberry Fair, and the Town and Country Show, we haven't enough time to sort of go around to all the more pubs and try and get it in places. But that's our next stage, so hopefully it's more and more pubs should be popping up with cranes in.
Cool. So where do you guys see yourself going?
Obviously we want to take over the world.
Naturally.
In reality, the next stage would be to sort of take it in a national level. Because obviously the plan is now to take over Cambridge and sort of establish ourselves within Cambridge. We would hopefully get a good business plan and prove that the product sells. And it's also a learning experience for us. Because you wouldn't want to tackle nationwide without some experience. So get a good business plan and then hopefully get some funding for a bigger factory and then, yeah, go national and then see how things go. But we've got some contacts with some marketing companies that are interested. So there is definitely England-wide potential there.
Cool. So why is it called Cranes?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, originally, when the European settlers went to America and saw the cranberry bush, they saw the flower look like a crane's head. So originally it was called Crane Berries. Well, then that got shortened to Cranberries.
Right.
So that's why our logo, with the R, is the crane's head. We thought we'd try and tie that in, so it's got some meaning to it.
Oh, that's really cool. Do you guys drink it often yourselves?
That's a good question. We do. At the beginning, well, I tell you what, when we were making the recipes, there was a couple of bad batches, so I had to encourage the guys to come over and sort of help me finish it off, playing some drinking games. But now we do drink quite a lot ourselves, unfortunately. Like.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Like,
yeah, no, you got to. If you don't have belief in it yourself, you're not where you're going to go.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got this weekend. We've got the garden parties the college garden parties at Newnham and Edward Murray. So we've got 1,500 bottles going to the Edward Murray's garden party, and then 650 litres going to the. Is it Newnham? I think it is. Is it Newnham College?
I have no idea.
Newnham. I think it is Newnham College.
We'll find it on Google.
Yeah, I think it's Newnham College, and they've got 615 litres going there. So there's a guy that actually goes to Cambridge University, and he's sort of setting up his own marketing company. So he was looking at sort of young businesses that want building up, and he could put on his portfolio to improve his sort of his business. So he's helping us out for free. So he's been. Working all the Cambridge University side of things for us, which has been great.
That's really cool, local, helping local.
Yeah, no, definitely, yeah, it's been brilliant.
So you said earlier that you can make up to 1,000 bottles a week?
Yeah.
How?
A lot of time.
Okay.
The liquid-wise, we've got like a massive mixing tanker and a big fermenter, so that the fermentation process takes about 2 weeks.
Right.
But then the longest process is the bottling, the labelling and the dating. That all done by hand by us. So that's what takes the biggest process, or the longest process. So the week, if we're washing out 1,000 bottles a week, there's a lot of labour going into that. It's going to take most of the week out. But that is probably our max capacity of our brewery at the moment.
Okay.
And recently we have been at max capacity, getting all our bottles ready for the all the big events we've had. But
yeah.
We're absolutely chuffed that within three or four months, our brewery's already at max capacity. It's brilliant.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So how, is it just you two doing this, or do you have people?
No, at the moment it's just me and my brother. We're sort of, working 7 days a week.
Wow.
But we are, and obviously we've got this guy, this marketing guy, who helps us out with the Cambridge University side of things. But we're actually getting one of our friends to help us out, who wants to sort of look into sales himself. So it's going to be good for him to put on his CV, but also we need a hand with sales as well, so he's going to help us out. So we might have four in our team, but not full time.
Cool. So what's your favourite part of the whole process? Is it selling, the making, the labelling?
I suppose the most rewarding one is the selling.
Right.
And it's good being there as well, watching. It's very rewarding watching people buying and drinking and enjoying the drink.
Yeah.
So that is very rewarding. So, like, for example, when we were at the Cambridge Beer Festival and we were there helping out selling our drink, and it was very rewarding seeing people buying our drink and coming back to buy more because they enjoyed it so much. That was really rewarding. And then also they had the Town and Country show where we sold 400 bottles. That was brilliant because people enjoyed our drink, had samples, and then bought some bottles. So that's probably the most rewarding and enjoyable thing.
Brilliant. How do you get the cranberries?
You can't. This isn't really the correct climate for growing cranberries here. So we actually, there's a supplier in the UK that gets them from America, so they ship it across frozen. So as soon as they get the cranberries, they harvest them.
Right.
They freeze them and then send them to the UK, and then we buy them from the supplier. Everyone I call up are so interested in the product that it's so unique, no one else has done it before. So like, pretty much everyone I call up, they always, yes, I'll have a meeting. And then from then, most of the time, they go for it.
That's really
good. Which is so handy. It's like selling is not really selling. It sells itself in a way, which is great. And hopefully it'll continue that way.
Yeah. Well, so thank you so much for meeting me, and good luck with everything.
That's all right, no problem. It's good to meet you.
So there we are, fermented cranberries, world domination beckons. We're sure to see more and more of Cranes as they are sure to expand, so have a look on their website, drinkcranes.co.uk, for a full stock list.
The Breakfast Show on Cambridge 105, a gentle way to start your Sunday. Relaxing music interspersed with hourly news to catch up with the stories locally and nationally. And traffic and travel for Cambridgeshire. A different guest reviewer each Sunday with the papers, a weekend sports roundup, and guests after 10 reflecting local organisations and services. Join me, Phil Rowe, from 8 this Sunday on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Well, we're joined in the studio by Tom Lewis, who's successfully cycled through the Gwydir Street
through
Party.
Through the street party, yeah. Quite a challenge.
Well done. And this week you're talking about dessert wines.
That's right,
for summer.
Yes. Dessert wines for summer, indeed.
Are there dessert wines for different seasons? I'd never really thought of that.
Yes. I mean, it is now officially the Great British Summer. in theory, it should be warm and sunny. I mean, think alfresco dining, Wimbledon with strawberries and cream.
Yep. And what should we look for in a dessert wine for summer? And what will it go with? Strawberries and cream, I suppose?
Well, yes. I mean, for summer wines, we're generally looking for lighter and fresher wines. So it's the same principle as we'd apply to dry wines.
Mm. So no sweet sherries, then?
At the height of summer, probably not. I would save those until it gets a bit cooler. If you think about a Pedro Ximenez, it's very dark and sticky. It's not something you want on a boiling hot summer's day. So the first wine I've selected absolutely is something that will go with strawberries and cream, and it's also sparkling, so you could use it to celebrate that ever-elusive British win at Wimbledon, should we get it this year. It's the Moscato Volpi Frizzante. It's from Cambridge Wine Merchants, and it's £9.49. It's very light, it's delicate, but it's Moorish, and it's really going to match well with the sweetness of fresh fruit. It's semi-sparkling, and it's just 5.5% alcohol. As a wine, it's very elegant, and there's lots of summery flavours of elderflower and ripe peach.
I think that 5.5% alcohol is a real selling point, actually.
It makes it very light as a wine, so it's going to go with the lightness of the fruit, absolutely.
Yeah, but also from the fact that you don't necessarily want to get sozzled every time you drink wine.
Or you could just invite more friends around to drink it with you.
Yeah. But are there any guides or rules to matching sweet wines to food?
The overall rule, the golden rule, is that the wine should be slightly sweeter than the food. If the food is sweeter than the wine, that's a complete no-no. in comparison to the sweeter food, the wine's going to seem tart and quite unpleasant.
Does that apply generally to all foods?
That's a general rule to all foods. So if you think there are some savoury foods that have some sweetness to them, things like gravlax, chicken liver pate, curries, or even a terrine if you serve it with a fruit chutney. So for all those kind of foods, I would match them with an off-dry wine. Things like a Gewürztraminer or Muscat typically have quite a bit of sugar left in them, and Rieslings also can come in off-dry versions.
Mm. What about the temperature that you serve dessert wines with? I've got the feeling that most of us, I certainly do, take them direct from the fridge, but I saw on the back of a bottle the other day, serve at 11 to 12 degrees C, and my fridge isn't 11.
It'll be cooler
than that. 5 degrees.
Yeah. I think definitely temperature's a big factor in how a wine's going to come across. The more you cool it, the more you're going to dull down all those aromatic flavours that you get. So to get it to 11 or 12, you're probably talking about half an hour in the fridge. If you leave it, you know, if it's been sitting there overnight, then it's going to be quite a bit cooler. And so maybe you want to open it up earlier and see how it warms up.
Mm, yeah. Okay, so what's next?
My next wine is a Moscato from Bacchanalia. So it's similar to the first one, the Volpi, in that it's an Italian, it's a Muscat, and it's sweet. But this one's not fizzy, and it's slightly fuller. It's called the Andrea Faccio Moscato d'Asti, and it's only $6.99 for a half bottle. As I say, it's from Bacchanalia. So this one is a still wine, but I think you could match this with something like a summer fruit tart. It's going to stand up to a pastry base in a way that I don't think the Volpi would. In terms of the flavours, it's ripe peach, apricot and Gallia melon. And there's a touch of sherbetiness as well. So plenty of ripe fruit. It's also refreshing enough to drink on its own at a garden party.
Mm, good. Why wouldn't it stand up to the pastry base?
I think the Volpi, because it's a lighter wine, really isn't going to match the weight of the pastry. The Moscato is slightly heavier and therefore will stand up to something slightly bigger food.
Yeah, okay. Right, you're a big fan of Austrian wines,
indeed,
aren't you?
Yes.
So any Austrians, do they do dessert wines? I don't know any, to be honest.
Dessert wines are one of the things they do best. They're perhaps less known for it, but absolutely. Austrian dessert wines, to me, are utterly world class. So I'm afraid I'm being very predictable again, but I do have some Austrian dessert wines. What I'm going to recommend for that is actually a whole range rather than a single bottle. The producer is called Kracher. And Kracher is the family name of a family of winemakers who are based near the border with Hungary. Now, I won't get into all the details of how they make them or I'll be able to talk forever. But Austrian dessert wines from this area are big, concentrated, complex, peachy and apricotty. They really are quite incredible.
Oh, well, they sound it, actually. What would you serve them with?
Well, because these are bigger wines, I think you can match them again with heavier desserts. So for this, for the Kracher range, I would look at something like peaches roasted in butter, put a sprinkling of vanilla sugar over the top. I think that would go perfectly well.
Yeah, well, it sounds lovely. And are they readily available?
Noel Young in Trumpington has the whole range of Kracher. They're numbered 1 to 11, and they're all in half bottles. Prices start from about £10 and go up from there.
What, 1 to 11 in terms of...?
The number on the bottle. So if you go into Noel Young's, look on the far shelf, he's just got a whole range of Kracher wines, starting with number 1, going up to number 11.
Okay.
Different grapes, different blends.
Oh, right. It doesn't refer to sweetness ratings.
No, not at all.
Okay. So, right, finally?
Finally, is there anybody here who likes chocolate?
Well, I think I do.
Occasionally, yes. just every day.
So, you know, chocolate, it's not exactly a summer dessert, but when we were thinking about this yesterday, the weather wasn't exactly summery either, was it?
No.
So this is just for those off days. I've often said that I don't think there's a wine that matches with chocolate. To me, I would normally match it either with a whiskey or a ruby port. But I did find something that will match perfectly. It's a sweet red. It's called Banyuls, and it's a perfect match for bitter dark chocolate.
And that's presumably because dark chocolate is less sweet than milk chocolate.
Exactly. Yeah. To match this properly, you need a high cocoa chocolate. So you'll have something with lots of bitterness, just a touch of sweetness, and plenty of cocoa aromatics. So that will match perfectly with the Banyuls, which is a region in Languedoc in southern France. So the one I've chosen is called Château de Joux, Les Clos de Polil. It's a 2008, it's from Joseph Barnes in Saffron Walden, and it's priced at £11.99 for 50 centilitres. So as I mentioned, it's a sweet red, which may seem a bit odd in a wine, but it is utterly delicious. It's a little bit like a port. It's got flavours of raisins, herbs, and a sort of sweet sharpness to it.
Mm. And any other areas to consider?
Well, if you're thinking about summer dessert wines generally, a couple of other ideas you could go for would be an off-dry German Riesling. Look for something from the Mosel. They're light summer sippers. They're perfect for sitting in the garden and drinking. Other areas to look at are Alsace, does some great dessert wines. They're a bit fuller, more suited to food, such as Gravelax. And also sweet Vouvray. And of course, the most famous dessert wine, of course, is Sauterne.
Mm, that sounds like a good lineup, but they're almost exclusively French?
Yes, mainly French or Northern European. And the reason for that is if we're thinking of summer dessert wines, we want something a bit lighter and cooler climate wines. The New World, of course, does do sweet wines. And of course, there's sherry and port as well, if you want something sweet. But as I said at the beginning, those are sort of heavier and they're more autumnal. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's come back to those later in the year. And
absolutely, I think that'd be a great idea.
Recommend some of those. Great, okay. So thanks, Tom, the Cambridge Wine Blogger, for that. Let's move on to the newspapers. The food pages in the papers today reflect the editor's expectation that summer would be at its height now. So The Independent has a summer food and drink special in its magazine. Rowley Lee in the Financial Times has an Italian salad, Panzanello, which he says is the perfect beginning to a leisurely summer lunch, but which looks great actually whatever the weather. In The Guardian, Fiona Beckett's wine column focuses on supermarket wines for barbecues. Mark Hicks too in The Independent focuses on light dishes, quinoa with summer beans, watermelon, strawberry, labneh and mint salad, for example, which looks brilliant by the way. However, there are more warming recipes to be found. Ricotta and oregano meatballs from Yotam Ottolenghi, for example.
Yeah, you said there was something from Tim Hayward's book in the Financial Times?
Yeah, there's a four-page extract, and hopefully we'll have time to get up to there. But let's begin with The Independent. The food and drink special begins with a list of 20 ideas for summer, and there are some food festivals coming up. Which it mentions, and ideas for places to eat. The Orchard Tea Rooms at Grantchester is one of them. But nothing about the East London Food Festival, for example. So it's a bit selective. Further on, in a feature called Bloke's Cuisine, with six recipes from Simon Cave for rather meaty meals, there's Anthony Rose recommending sparkling and rosé wines, most of which are easily available. But if you're going to buy The Independent today, I'd get it for Mark Hicks's recipes, broad bean, spider crab and chilli salad, tomato and cumin salad. They sound fantastic. Mm. But the big news, as far as I'm concerned, is the start of the gooseberry season. This year, the first for a long time, gooseberries and elderflowers are both available at the same time, and they're a stunning combination.
Okay, so are there any good gooseberry recipes in the new papers?
Yeah, I'd rather hope that Hugh Fernley Whittingstall would have done a piece on them, but today he's talking about meringues. But Yotam Ottolenghi's second recipe is for ricotta pancakes with gooseberry relish, and he says in his recipe that the quantity of the relish yields more than you'll need, but because the gooseberry season is so short and they are so wonderful, he's left some over for the fridge and you can have it on toast at breakfast.
That's rather unusual, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I will have to make it soon. The elderflower season is also very short. In fact, in the Guardian's cook supplement, there's a recipe for gooseberry and elderflower muscat syrup, and he says that the syrup can be used as a cordial to make a superior a superior drink, or as the basis for a very delicate flavoured dessert.
Mm. Is that going to taste too lemony?
Well, my elderflower cordial does taste lemony. The lemon's much too overpowering, but the great thing about this recipe is there is no lemon in it. Let's move on, since the time's running out. Tim Hayward's book. From the extract in the Financial Times, it looks beautifully written, and he explains how he's always been interested in making and doing. So the book, with its focus on things like curing your own bacon, making your own Gravelax and salami, potting your own lobster, it just seems right, and you feel it's not written to fill a gap that an accountant has found in the market, but because it is of him, and it's out next week.
Lovely. Well, thanks very much, Alan. That brings us to the end of another show, and many thanks to all of our contributors. Arthur from the Taste of Cambridge food stall on Market Street, Clara Paul of Books for Cooks, Roger Frost from The Science Show and his guest Steve Poyser, Dan Crane of Crane's Alcoholic Cranberry, and Cambridge wine blogger Tom Lewis, of course.
And don't forget to follow Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105. That's where you'll read about the news we discover ourselves, and we also retweet food and drink stories from other Cambridge sources. The next edition will be on Saturday, July the 13th at midday, and you can find our previous episodes on our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website.
So do join us again next time. Coming up next is Saturday Lunch with Davina and George.
Goodbye.
Bye.